Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Aroused is the history of hormones and how they control just about everything from our metabolism and mood swings to our immune system and sleep. Medical journalist Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein takes the reader on a fascinating journey of the unique history and science behind one of medicine's most important discoveries, hormones. Arno Boethold, a German doctor, performed the first scientific hormone experiment in his backyard 170 years ago. He castrated a couple of roosters, and they got sluggish and fat and stopped chasing hens. Next, he implanted the testicle in the belly of one of the castrated roosters, which reinvigorated the male. This really launched the field of endocrinology. Author of Aroused, Randy Hutter Epstein is an adjunct professor at Columbia University and a lecturer at Yale University. She lives in New York. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Psychology Today blog, among others. Dr. Epstein, welcome to 411 Teen.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, I read your book, and fascinating is just the only thing I can say about it. Why did you decide to write Aroused?
You know, I've been fascinated with history of medicine, and after delving into medical archives and newspapers and also interviewing experts, endocrinologists, and speaking with people, menopausal women like myself, teenagers, mm-hmm. boys and girls, I realized that there's so much confusion when we hear about hormones, and I wanted to set the record straight. I wanted to make the distinction between some of the fabulous advances in science but also some of the ridiculous, outrageous claims. And I think, some of these ridiculous, outrageous claims make for great stories. They certainly do, but I'm hoping that my readers then will be able to say, okay, that doesn't make sense, but this does.
What is the significance of the title, Aroused?
Oh, well, thanks for asking, because I think some people might think it has a different significance than what the doctor in 1905 was thinking when he was thinking about the word aroused. So in 1905, I won't get into all the details, it's in the book, but there was a British scientist who really came up with the concept of hormones. But he wanted a good word. The word hormone didn't exist yet, and he needed a word for something about these secretions that he said aroused other glands mm-hmm. in the body. That's what he was thinking. So he did what doctors do. You know, we need highfalutin words that come from the Greek, because then it sounds that much more important. And he went to one of his friends, who was a Cambridge University classics professor, and said, I need a word in Greek that means to arouse, as in arousing other cells in the body, chemicals that arouse other cells. And his friend said, how about the word hormoa, something mm-hmm. along the lines of hormoa. So that's how he came up with hormones. Now, he wasn't quite this innocent, naive doctor. He knew that there was something about the chemicals in ovaries and testes that were arousing in the way we think of it. But when he gave his talk to all those austere doctors at the Royal Society of London, he intentionally, when he talked about glands in the body, he intentionally left out testes and ovaries. He talked about the pancreas, mm-hmm. the pituitary, because he didn't want people to think that he was like some wacky, like sexy kind of field that he was launching.
Well, I know when I think of aroused, I really didn't think about the sexual desire, the connection that went with it. I thought of, you know, boosting, turning things on, so to speak, exciting things, you know, boosting hunger and growth and puberty, particularly this with this program. Of course, we think of puberty and energy, and the list just goes on and on. What was it particularly about hormones that piqued your interest?
Well, I think, again, you know, I was interested because I think that there's a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. But I also think two things. One is that, yes, they do have such control in ways we understand. And in growth hormone, insulin, we understand so much, but in also ways we don't understand. And I think that's what makes science fascinating, to say here's the seed of what we think we know, but yet we're not quite sure yet. The other thing that I have just this personal fascination with is I am just fascinated with tiny things that pack a powerful punch. Maybe because I'm not quite 5'2" and never will be, and I guess according to statistics, I'm going to start shrinking now that I'm 55. But hormones come in tiny, tiny packets. Like, we're talking like nanograms, like just teeny little bits, and yet pack this powerful punch. So when you have too much of a hormone, we're not talking like an extra cup, like when you're baking. We're talking like sprinkling a little, one little grain of salt extra, and that can really cobble your system. And I just find that absolutely fascinating, that these tiny, tiny amounts of chemicals can have such power over the body.
Well, I tell you, I really enjoyed your book. I mean, it was well written. It was very informative. It resonated in a number of different ways. You captured, one thing I liked is how you captured the style and the personality of the scientists. I'm definitely a proponent of your book. Will you share just what are hormones and what role they play? I mean, I know we've said they excite, but what are they?
Sure. I mean, you know, we tend to talk about, like, oh, hormonal, as if it's like women going off the rails. Oh, you know, you're a 17-year-old girl and you're in a terrible mood. Obviously, it's your hormones. No, maybe someone really did piss you off. So we think of it as this, like, very nebulous concept. It's not nebulous at all. The definition of a hormone is very simple. It's a chemical secreted from one gland in the body that reaches a faraway target. We don't mean far away, like New York City to Florida. Mm-hmm. We mean far away, like brain to testes or brain to ovaries. Mm-hmm. And that might seem to listeners now as if, well, everything does that. You know, you leave something and you hit a target. But you have to think about this concept. I like to say that hormones are like your internal Wi-Fi. They're like your wireless internet. But that's not the way we thought the body worked before we discovered hormones. So a lot of things, a lot of messages in your body travel along nerves. That's like thinking like train tracks in a way. They just kind of go right along, everything connected. Then we also have messages in the body. If you think of oxygen, it kind of floats along in the blood like a raft going down a river, and it just sort of bangs into where it's needed along the way. But hormones are remarkable because they are released from one little cell in the body in your glands, and they know exactly where they're going. So that's why if you need insulin, for instance, if you're a diabetic, you don't have to get that insulin into your pancreas so that it can get on some chain loop. You can inject insulin anywhere you want, and it knows its target. So it's a pretty phenomenal concept, and it's pretty remarkable to think that this is how our bodies work with these very specific messages.
Well, that was the exact concept that Dr. Berthold was demonstrating when he castrated the chickens, or roosters, rather.
Absolutely. And so the reason I love this story, and you told it so nicely about this doctor that castrated a rooster, and then for whatever reason, you know, he shoved the testicle into the belly of another castrated rooster just to see if it would work anywhere. And I think it's really a model for good science, but not great science, because one is he asked a great question. And everyone knows, like, that's scientists aren't great scientists just because they have good answers. They're great scientists because they have great questions. Mm-hmm. So his question was, would a gland, a testicle, work no matter where it's put in the body? Mm-hmm. And it did. That was a one. So he had a great question. And then he did a very simple, elegant experiment. So that was also good. But then the third thing he did, which was good but not great, he published in a scientific journal, that's great. But then he didn't really understand the huge ramifications of this experiment, and this journal was just shoved on a shelf somewhere in 1848, and no one really recognized its importance for a half a century, for another generation. So it was really these doctors in 1905 that came up with the word hormone. They discovered his discovery. So it's just an interesting thing, sort of, how science works or sometimes doesn't work.
Well, explain to us, if you can give us an abbreviated review of the endocrine system. Since hormones are produced by glands in this system, and the glands, all the glands are working together to manage the body's major hormones, right?
They are. And, you know, so we have, I'm not going to go through all of them now, but we have, like, the hypothalamus is a gland in the brain. And then it talks to the pituitary, another gland in the brain. And then our other glands include the thyroid in our neck, the adrenal glands that cap the kidneys, and your testes or ovaries, and your pancreas. But it gets so complicated because it works in a beautiful way, I would rather say, than complicated, because our bodies know all these what we like to call feedback loops, either positive or negative. Mm-hmm. So your pituitary in your brain sometimes controls what we call releasing hormones. It will send out messages to say to the adrenal gland, start pumping now. It'll send out messages to the ovary. You know, so puberty starts really from a message in the brain. Mm-hmm. And we know, we've done studies to show when people are very stressed. They're stressed, they're not eating. You know, if you think about a young woman who isn't eating, has an eating disorder, and becomes way too thin, that puts her body in a lot of stress. And that can signal her pituitary, this body is under stress, and that can stop menstruation. You know, we've known that for a while, that women who don't eat enough or anorexic stop menstruating, and now we're really understanding it has to do with not just the one hormone of menstruation, not just your ovarian hormones, but the way your body is talking to your ovaries. But in a normal ebb and flow way, the endocrine system works that if your adrenal glands, for instance, are making cortisol, which is a stress hormone, that also sends a signal to the brain, okay, there's enough cortisol now in the system, and your brain will tell the adrenal gland to slow down. Oh, so we have these checks and balances. When things are working well, the checks and balances. That's why insulin goes up after you eat, and then there will be a signal to have it go down.
We need to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, author of a recent book, Arouse, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Dr. Epstein, I had to interrupt you when you were talking about the adrenal glands. If you will continue, I would appreciate it.
Sure, and I was really just saying that when the body is working the way it should be, we have these checks and balances that doctors call feedback loops. Feedback loop meaning, you know, if you think of things in a circle, that if one part of the circle, if on one end of like an oval, we'll think of a lot is coming out, it signals to the other side, okay, now we don't need as much. So your brain is constantly talking to your body. When the brain realizes, wow, you just had a lot of estrogen come out, now we don't need it, now it'll go down. So we're constantly in these ups and downs of hormones in the body.
And that is what contributes to these changes, whatever they may be. The mood swings that we see in adolescence, the hot flashes that we see in menopause, these changes in the hormone. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Hormone levels, right?
Absolutely. Now, we can't always say, you know, there are some women that will feel particularly angry and moody before their period. We don't always know exactly what's going on. I do like to say that hormones don't make you stupid. So, you know, it's not like you can roll your eyes and say, wow, you know, she's P PMS. That was stupid of her to say. No, she might have been a little angrier, but she probably meant what she said, and it didn't make her stupid. You know, it's a lot of times it's just adjusting and realizing. I think sometimes these mood swings, once we can understand that it's temporary and, oh, it might be related to getting my period, not all women have it, but some, even just knowing that can make you feel better than thinking, oh, no, I'm going crazy and this is going to last forever, or I hate everybody right now and this is going to be the way I feel forever.
Problems with hormones can cause serious life-altering, I guess, symptoms like bones. You can have osteoporosis and thyroid disorders and growth problems in children, to name a few. And even now, the transgender health issues. So you see hormones involved just about in every aspect of our lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things, on a positive note, I like to say is that if you're under the care of an endocrinologist or someone that knows hormones, a lot of these things can be monitored. And it's amazing what we can do now. So when I was working on the book, I happened to be in my neighborhood in New York City, and a woman came up to me, someone I just know from walking my dogs, and said, we were chatting and said, oh, you're writing about hormones. Well, I should tell you about my son. And she said his pituitary gland, they found out when he was younger, really doesn't communicate with the rest of his body. And that's, you know, what I was just talking about, this brain-body feedback. Now, if that child had been born 100 years ago, this would have been someone who would have survived, but he would have been cognitively impaired, mm-hmm. never gone through puberty, and not grown very much. But today, because we can measure hormones, he was top in his high school class. He's brilliant. He's gone through puberty, and he just gets monitored. He can get the testosterone he needs and the growth hormone he needs, make sure his insulin is well, and he has a doctor who's like his best friend who keeps in charge of his levels. He's gone off to college. He knows how to check in. And I think that none of his friends even knew he had a hormone issue because it's just so under control. Mm-hmm. So it's really astonishing, a lot of the things. You know, we can't control every aspect of our personality. For girls who have really horrible PMS, no, we don't really have a great cure for that yet. But for some of these kids that would have had serious issues years ago, generations ago, they can live normal, healthy lives. So it's amazing, a lot of the wonderful advances that we've had.
Well, when you talk about years ago, I can't help but think of the example you used in the book, The Fat Lady, I think it was. Blanche Gray, who, you know, was ridiculed, and obviously she had some type of metabolic disorder, some, you know, a hormonal issue that was going on. But how was she treated? And I think that we have made some progress in how we address individuals who may be a little different, where hormones have gone awry, so to speak. Would you agree?
We've made some progress, and mm-hmm. we still need to be a more accepting society and more tolerant of each other. We still need to realize that, yes, there are people that look differently. It could be a hormone imbalance, but even if it's not, we have to accept people. We're starting to be more accepting that there are some people who down deep know that their external anatomy doesn't match how they feel mm-hmm. inside. We're becoming mm-hmm. more accepting of the transgender community, but obviously we all know we're not quite there yet. What I write about in the book was such an awful chapter in American history, that people that were considered abnormal, whether they had, we didn't think hormones then, but we're talking people that we can look back, like the bearded lady in the circus, mm-hmm. we've all heard of that. There was just the P.T. Barnum movie out. Women who grow too much facial hair, we now know, have a hormone imbalance that can be treated. No, they should not be displayed in a circus to be mocked at, which is something that we did do in the 1880s and in the early 1900s in our country. And, I mean, there was someone, when I looked into Blanche Gray and this woman who was the fat bride in the circus, so an obese woman about 500 pounds who was in the circus. The people that sat near her was someone called the Armless Wonder. So we're talking about somebody that was born with a birth mm-hmm. defect and had no arms, and they were put in the circus too. I mean, it's such an awful, embarrassing time, yet another awful chapter in American history when we dehumanized other people that we thought were too different from us.
Well, there were some wild stories. I mean, the promotion of vasectomies to boost libido. And
yeah, I mean, to me, that really, you know, we can laugh at that, but there's, you know, but it also realized that there's probably a lot going on now that people in 50 years are going to laugh
right.
at.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And the story of that, you know, in the 1920s, it became this fad, that this claim that getting a vasectomy would boost your libido. It doesn't for everyone
no.
out there. You know, you might feel more comfortable if you're an older man knowing you're not going to impregnate mm-hmm. someone, but it's not a libido booster, and it's not going to make you think more clearly as some men in the 1920s did. It was a huge fad, so much so that the guy named Steinach who promoted it, his name became a verb. So you could get Steinacht. You didn't even call it getting a vasectomy. But what that chapter shows, I try to make sort of have a subtle or not so subtle lesson in every chapter, is that why were people jumping on the bandwagon and getting vasectomies? There was no science.
Mm-mm.
No, because of all these testimonies. And we hear it today, too. People go to their doctor and say, I think I need X, or I think I should take something out of my diet. And their doctor might say, well, you really don't have a food allergy, or you really can eat that. And they'll say, no, 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 but I have 20 friends who testify that this is the best way. And it's so hard, and mm-hmm. I think that's the history of our medicine, is we have a lot of trouble looking at the data. We'd much rather believe our friend and say, oh, that's that, then I'm going to do the same thing.
Or we want to believe Madison Avenue, because now we have, you know, pharma advertising all these different medications, and so I think patients tend to diagnose and treat themselves. So when they go in to see the physician, they know what they need, and they'll go in and ask directly for that particular pill or that particular treatment, which may not be indicated at all. But Madison Avenue plays a big role today. I mean, would you
Absolutely.
Agree? I think Madison Avenue plays a huge role.
Absolutely. They'll make you feel deficient in
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
They'll make you feel like, oh, you're some area like vaginal cleanliness. When you are clean enough, you don't have
right.
to buy anything more. I think, you know, there's this fear. They plant a fear that something isn't pretty enough or isn't whatever is boosted enough as it should be. But if you just get this one product. But if you don't get that product, then you're going to walk around thinking that you don't
right.
smell right or look right or act right or think right. So, yeah, I think that's a huge issue. And I think for some people the problem is if your doctor says, no, you don't need it, they'll just find another
yeah.
doctor.
They go doctor shopping till they get what they want.
Yeah, it's expensive, and it could have side effects. I mean, you know, even all natural things have side effects. And people say, well, it's all natural. But if you're taking anything that you believe is potent enough to cause an effect, then it is likely to be potent enough to cause a side effect. So I think people have to remember that.
Well, would you take a few minutes and talk about human growth hormone? Because I think that's something that today, at least you hear a lot about. I know pediatricians will tell me how often parents will come in and say that they want this human growth hormone. And I know you did a chapter, or you talked about it, where these desperate parents were using cadavers as a source of human growth hormone to treat their son.
Right. Well, I want to distinguish between all the growth hormone today is synthetic.
Yes.
So
yes.
we don't use growth hormone from humans mm-hmm. anymore. And that we learned after tragic consequences in the 60s. And again, I don't blame anyone for what was going on then. Doctors, scientists, for the most part, were doing what they
right.
thought was right. It was the 60s, so the thinking was, oh, something all natural from the human body would be much better than anything synthetic. There was not synthetic growth hormone available, but people were actually afraid of it. And what I write about in the book is a time when, in some ways, it was a triumph. They realized that for people that would be called little people or what they called dwarfs then, that growth hormone could help them. But it had to come from humans. It couldn't come from cows or pigs the way we get insulin from animals. It doesn't work with growth hormone. So in some ways, this was considered a triumph. We were able to collect growth hormone. And yes, we got it from the pituitary, a brain gland of cadavers. There were some people at the time murmuring, maybe we're not purifying the growth hormone enough, but they weren't listened to. So it wasn't until 20 years later in the 1980s that we realized that some batches of growth hormone were contaminated with a deadly infection that made some of these people, I think it's up to now 33 people in the United States, it was 119 in France, had this disease that in their 20s they had like a dementia and shortly died after. Right when we made that link, all growth hormone from humans was taken off the market, and now all growth hormone is synthetic. So we're not worried about any more contaminants in growth hormone, but again, it's like it's become in some ways a business. There are children who do not have enough growth hormone, which means they won't go through puberty, which means they have other issues with insulin metabolism. Everything is connected. For those children that get growth hormone, that can be a real lifesaver for them. But there's a whole other market, as you know, of kids that might be 5'8", and they're hoping, the parents are hoping that they could be 6'4". And this has become, not only do you have to worry about the effects of growth hormone, you know, connecting to insulin, connecting to all the other things in your body and having side effects that you shouldn't have, but it's also expensive. It's also become this two-tiered system. And in some ways, it's protecting people that can't afford it. But to get growth hormone, I mean, you don't really need it, is pricey. So in some ways, if you can't afford it, maybe that's a good thing that you're not taking a hormone you don't need. But it's worrisome for parents that feel desperate that they have to get this so their child is a few inches taller. And I'm hoping, again, it goes with acceptance. We were just talking about just accepting people who are different.
And I think parents need to understand that heredity does play a role here.
And absolutely.
You can get this growth hormone, but if you're meant to be 5'8", growth hormone is not going to make you 6'10".
No, it doesn't. It's not that much of a miracle cure at all. Yeah, and we're not even sure. You know, the studies back in the 60s, you can't really take two people. I mean, you could, but we haven't taken two people that are genetically the same, like twins, and give one growth hormone and not give the other and see the final effect. Because you never really know exactly how tall someone is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, once your growth plates, once you've finished your vertical climb, then growth hormone will just make your jaw bigger and your hands. You know, we see that in people that have pituitary tumors. So you have to give the growth hormone before the growth plates seal. But again, you know, I just think you want to use, like any drug, like hormones are like any drug. If you need it and if you're deficient, then there's some wonderful things it can do. But you don't want to get into this sort of almost cosmetic use of these potent hormones. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, this is a program that focuses particularly on teens and adolescents and parenting. And I know you touched on it a little bit, but would you elaborate on the characteristics of puberty? Because so often what parents are seeing that's going on in puberty as far as physiological changes, even emotional changes, are normal. I mean,
absolutely.
And so if you don't mind, if you would, you know, talk about the characteristics, the hormonal characteristics of puberty.
Sure. And one of the things, you know, that we're starting to learn now is that you tend to think, I mean, for girls, you tend to think, okay, as soon as they get their period, that's when it sets in.
No.
It's a marker.
Right.
You know, boys, maybe you could see, you know, you'll be getting hair, genital hair. Of course, parents aren't really monitoring at that age. It's not like, oh, great. But But it's, you know, that's just one sign. Children really start to feel and experience some of the subtle effects of hormonal changes building up to when we think puberty kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if your daughter or if a young woman listening things like, okay, I got my period when I was 12. Well, she might have started to feel differently about 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. Now, what exactly is triggering some of these mood swings? You can't always say, oh, it's this hormone or that. It could be that some of the hormonal changes are starting to make her body alter in ways, getting breasts, getting hips. So you're mm-hmm. physically changing. You might be gaining weight. You might be feeling more bloated. Now, just physically feeling different can be very distressing for some women. So again, that can trigger some bad mood swings, or just feeling so different can make you want to just be by yourself and not be as social. For fears, it's almost, I think, for some young children, you start to feel a lack of control for the first time. And I think that can be very frightening, and that can be very distressing, because up until those first little hints of puberty, not that you think about it, but you kind of do feel in control of your body. And then all of a sudden puberty hits, and it's an awful time because, you know, friendships are changing. Like, your life feels completely out of control. Friendships change, personalities change. Who the person that was your best friend at 9 years old might be completely different from 11, especially because puberty hits kids at different times. And so you might have a 12-year-old friend that, boys and girls I'm talking about now, mm-hmm. their brains are changing. All these hormones affect the brain. So the way testosterone will flood into the system for a young man might have him thinking about different things compared to some of his friends that haven't hit puberty.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I am talking with Dr. Epstein. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
This is 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. And joining me via phone in New York is Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein. Dr. Epstein is a writer in residence at Yale School of Medicine. She talks about her new book, Aroused, released June 2018. Dr. Epstein, I had to interrupt you. You were talking about puberty, particularly in males. Would you continue?
Sure. And I mean, I was really talking boys and girls, but I mm-hmm. brought out males just so that people wouldn't think I was just talking
right.
female. That it's a really confusing time for teens because hormonally and non-hormonally, I think the hormones induce changes. So if you're 12 years old, boy or girl, and you're feeling your body is different, and maybe your friend isn't feeling that yet, that can cause just changes in the way you're thinking compared to your friend. So that can just, things start mixing up in your body and outside. So I think the big issue in teenagehood is it's this very uncontrollable situation. And I think some teens feel, God, I'm going through such a weird time, or mm-hmm. I hate my body, or I'm changing and nothing fits, and I can't talk to anybody about it. So you shut down, and you'd rather just be, you know, nasty to your parents than talk about it. And I feel like I'm on this radio show feeling like I must have been the best parent for my four kids going through this time. And I don't want any misconceptions, because it isn't easy. You know, I've mm-hmm. done, you know, when my girls were sometimes nasty to me, I'm sure I would just screamed right back at them, and there wasn't anything in me saying, like, oh, wow, maybe they're going through a changing time and I should ease up. I'm thinking, gosh, don't let my kids hear this radio show. They're going to think you falsely represented yourself. So in the real ideal world of parenting, it'd be wonderful if we were all understanding of our hormonal swings and be more appreciative of our ups and downs. But I would say for teenagers, I think you know, as long as we can start to accept, which is a difficult thing, our changing bodies and just being a little more self-compassionate, maybe. But it's not easy, especially because one of our friends, the effects of their hormones might be they're getting super tall and skinny, and maybe you're staying short with bigger boobs than you wanted, and there's jealousy, and maybe your tall and skinny friend is thinking, I have no physique, and you have the curves. So it's just, it's a crazy time, internally and externally. I don't think any adult would like to replay that time in our lives.
Right. We're talking about the book, but share with the listening audience where they can purchase the book. Is it online? Where is it?
Sure. Aroused is available online and wherever you get your books, hopefully in your independent bookstore and all the major Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Indie, all the major sources for getting your book.
Well, in your book, you explored the 1920s, the notion that criminality could be linked to that hormones control behavior, and including the ability to predict an individual's capacity for violence. And you talked about that famous Leopold Ebb murder case. And would you talk about that and the impact of this idea?
Sure. I love talking about legal trials because they make for good reading.
Mm-hmm.
And just in a little short tidbit, and people can read the rest, the Leopold and Loeb trial was considered the crime of the century. 1924, two rich kids from Chicago tried to get away with murder, and they didn't. So when it went to the courts, their parents were able to hire the best defense attorney, who then hired two doctors who basically tried to get the boys off of, show that they weren't guilty, because the boys admitted to the murder, but to lessen the sentence by basically saying their hormones made them do it. It's fascinating because this was the 1920s. We could not measure hormones then. We didn't know a lot about them the way we do now. And yet, these two doctors x-rayed the boys and interviewed them and did all sorts of weird kind of tests. And then they came up with a 300-page, 80,000-word report to the judge that basically said, oh, multiglandular defect, pineal gland hardening, they had no inhibition, this is why they murdered. The judge at the time basically said, I mean, he used very judgy, legally words, but I'll paraphrase by basically the judge said, wow, this is fascinating. This science of hormones is absolutely fascinating. It's not going to get these two kids off the hook. And they weren't kids. I mean, they were about 19 or 20 then. And they got life sentences plus 99 years for kidnapping because they kidnapped and killed a child. The fascination is that we've always been drawn to what can hormones predict about behavior. We're still looking at things called like neurolaw and the neuroscience of law. I still think it's not going to get anyone off the hook. You're not going to find somebody that has a hormone defect and say, oh, okay, well then don't worry about that murder that you just did. But from a scientific point of view, I think we're still trying to figure out what is the chemical basis for people that are so socially, behaviorally off that will do things that are so inhumane. We're not there yet, but it's a fascinating scientific look. But again, you know, in the 1920s, there were people promoting best-selling books. You know, it's kind of the Madison Avenue thing, saying, here, I can tell you what hormone you have too much or too little of and how you can cure yourself and be better and all sorts of things like that.
What are the common misunderstandings about how hormones work and what they do? Because for me, I see the key to understanding hormones is just the interconnectedness. But if you would share the common misunderstandings.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of little tiny myths that go around, but I would say to get back to what you said about interconnectedness, yes, that people tend to visualize, you know, like garden hoses lying next to each other, growth hormone in one, testosterone in the other. You know, you have too much or too little, you can just control that little path. Mm-hmm. But it's more thought of as like a cobweb. They're all interconnected. So you boost one hormone, it's going to affect the levels of another. And now, lately, we've been seeing hormones are connected to your immune system. So you're not just playing with your hormones when you start fiddling with levels. You're affecting your immune system as well. So I think this interconnectedness is very key to the way we picture hormones. And then I would say, okay, so then a few little misconceptions that come around just from either wives' tales or whatever. We know that there's a big normal range for testosterone levels that go up and down during the day. And there's this thought that even if you're in the normal range, let's say 400 or 500 on one of the scales that measure hormones, and if you boost it from 400 to 500 or 500 to 550, mm-hmm. you're going to feel a little better. You're going to like, that's going to make a difference in your libido and strength that night. No, the studies kind of show that within that normal level, the little ups and downs are not going to make that huge difference in behavior. So that's one little myth. Then when it comes to women, like there, it used to be that it was thought while you're nursing, you're never going to get pregnant. Breastfeeding definitely has an impact on the pituitary and probably mm-hmm. does when you first give birth, impact your fertility while you're nursing in those first month or so. It's definitely not a good contraception. You could have women tell you they've had one baby after another. They were pregnant. I got pregnant when I was nursing, but mm-hmm. I was nursing for 3 years at that point. So that's another myth. So don't think breastfeeding is the best method of contraception. And I think the other thing is, even when we know people that are taking certain levels, you know, on a birth control pill or taking estrogen, you really want to be under the care of a doctor. The birth control pills, for instance, out now are much lower dose than the ones that were around in the 80s when I was on a birth control pill. Then it was much higher dose. Mm-hmm. They're much lower dose. They're safer, but it doesn't mean it's 100% safe. There are some people, especially if you're a smoker or for other reasons, that might put you at an increased risk of a blood clot from estrogen. So whenever you're putting anything like that in your body, you really do want to be under the care of a physician.
What about, I guess I would call it hormone abuse, steroid and hormone abuse. And I think about these athletes who may be taking steroids or even women and men who are using excessive amounts of, I guess it's hair growth, Rogaine. That, would you talk some about that in these last few minutes?
The Rogaine, I don't think, is a hormone. But, but getting your hands on testosterone, I mean, anyone knows. You mm-hmm. want something, you can find someone out. You can probably even find a doctor that will give it to you. It's really scary. I met someone years ago who was a bodybuilder in Europe. And he was huge. He looked like, you know, when you go to the gym, mm-hmm. you think, wow, that guy must be on something. And I said to him, he admitted it. He said his goal was to be Mr. Universe. Mm. He was pumping up on steroids. I guess he just assumed he wouldn't get caught. And I said to him, you realize this is shriveling your testicles. Probably not something most people say to someone in the gym, but I said it. You realize this is shriveling your testicles, and you're really skyrocketing the risk of getting a heart attack. And mm-hmm. he was like, oh, I don't care as long as I become Mr. Universe. Mm. And you should care. You really should care. This stuff is dangerous. And also, I don't know, to look like one of those steroid people like that muscular just looks kind of awful.
It does.
It's just awful. And you don't want to shrivel your testicles. You don't want to increase your risk of a heart attack. You don't want to get, like, you can really get, on those really high doses, yes, it can make you a little crazy, more irritable, more impulsive. It's such a dangerous thing to do, and there are ways to get it over the counter. There are supplements that have it in it, and it's really scary, particularly when there's ways to get in shape without messing up your system that much. It's, you know, it's definitely slower. You know, it means you have to work out harder. But it's really scary. And I know teenagers, you want things right away. I mean, mm-hmm. adults kind of do too. We want the quick fix. We want someone to say, take this. It's gonna make each workout count double. But you know what? Eventually it's gonna wear off. Eventually, you know, you get that heart attack, you're not gonna be working out. So I just really think that people should be aware of all this excess stuff that's around.
Well, I just got a text. Someone wanted me to ask you, and I know we kind of talked about it, exactly what do endocrinologists do?
Ah, good question. They're like the heroes of my book. I really relied on them. I'm not an endocrinologist, but I rely on them to feed me the expert information. Endocrinologists are doctors that have done extra years of study after they become either an OBGYN or an internal medicine doctor to really understand the hormones in the body. So they really are the ones to go to if you think that there might be some hormonal issue. So that's what they do, and they understand the whole range. So they're not just specialized in the testes mm-hmm. or the pituitary. They tend to have a real good insight into the overview, and they understand the ups and downs. So if you're fiddling with hormones, and a lot of times I would say that, I mean, there are OBGYNs, for instance, your gynecologist. There are some, they know a lot about hormones, and many of them are do take extra years to study endocrinology as well. But I would say that even some of your doctors, sometimes if things are a little baffling, will say, now you might want to see an endocrinologist because mm-hmm. they understand sort of the minutia of some of the hormones that we might not think of right away. Because there's so many hormones in the body. I mean, thousands that, like, there's helper hormones. There's hormones in the pathways of hormones. So that's why these experts really have a good handle on the minutia of all these pathways.
What role has the study of hormones had in understanding gender?
You know, we're still, you know, gender is an interesting concept. It used to be in the old days, if you had an ovary, you were a girl. If you mm-hmm. had a testy, you were a boy. We called it sex. We didn't even call it gender. You know, yeah. your sex right. was boy or girl. Then we came up with this concept of gender, which really takes in chromosomes, XX or XY, whether you have ovaries or testes. But the big thing is it takes in how you consider yourself, how you feel about yourself. We don't know what that means in terms of hormone levels. So, yes, we can do animal studies and inject them with extra testosterone or block their testosterone. But the bottom line is when we look at people, for instance, who identify as transgender, it's real, and there are many people who, to the core, will say, the way I feel doesn't match the way I look on the outside. Mm-hmm. And can we do a blood test to say, yes, you're transgender, or no, you're not? No, mm-hmm. there's no such thing as a blood test. Can we look at the brain of someone and say, oh, that's a transgender brain, or that's a male or female? No, we can't. You know, every now and then there will be a study and say, this study showed this about the transgender brain. We're not there yet, and it's really complicated. On the one hand, there's a lot of interesting studies going on, so we can really understand the issue of gender and why some people may feel one way and not the other. There's also a lot of pushback from the community, because if they feel strongly that they identify as transgender, they don't want someone to say, oh, well, you failed this blood test. So it's a very controversial time now. And I also want to say that we conflate all these things together, mm-hmm. that gender identity is not the same thing as sexual orientation. So whether you're attracted to someone of the same gender as you or different gender is very right. different from gender identity, how you feel about yourself.
In this last minute, would you share some of the great, what you would identify as the greatest medical advances that have emerged from hormone research?
Well, I'll say in, you know, less than a minute, the greatest medical advance that came from hormone research was our ability to measure hormones. And I love to say of this male-female partnership, the female on the team, the woman, in the 1940s, when she said she wanted to become a scientist, was told, hey, this is the 1940s and you're a woman, become a secretary for a scientist. She persisted and she revolutionized 20th century medicine before this technique, which was called radioimmunoassay, before this technique in the 1960s, you couldn't measure hormones at all. You went to the doctor, and if he said you didn't have enough growth hormone, it was basically guesswork. After this technique from this couple that developed this technique, we could measure hormones down to the billionth of a gram. It came out of endocrinology, but it's the same technique used to find the HIV virus and AIDS. It's responsible for fertility treatments. It's responsible for cancer markers. Anything that we thought was too tiny to measure, we can now measure because of this technique.
Well, we are out of time. I would like to really extend my sincere appreciation for a super program. I thought it was so very informative. Many thanks to my listening audience for your ear and your time. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.